words about the institute where I come from, because we are quite a special setup at LSE. So Grantham Research Institute was founded in 2008, and it's chaired by Lawrence Stern, who is quite a prominent economist in the field of green growth and climate change, and he actually comes to China quite a lot to advise also China governments on environmental issues. We have collaborations with some other universities and a sister organization at the Imperial College in London. We have two arms. One is Academic Research Institute, which does academic research on climate change and environment. And we also have a policy arm, which is the work that I'm heading at the Institute. And our function is, on one hand, to translate academic research for policymakers so that we can make impact on policy decisions. And on the other hand, we also do policy analysis on particular issues which are currently on the agenda. And I will talk about some of those shortly. Here are some of the issues. We have nine programs at the Institute. We look at issues such as green growth and the economy, carbon markets and climate finance. We look also at more and decision-making and uncertainty, at adaptation to climate change impacts and how that affects poverty and development, and also at international negotiations. So what I'd like to talk to you about today are basically three things. One is to describe a little bit the challenge that is ahead of us in terms of addressing climate change and transitioning to a low-carbon economy. And you might know that this year is a very important year for this issue because we expect an important conference in December in Paris, which is expected to come up with a new framework for addressing climate change internationally for the next 15 years. I will talk about what are the key issues for that conference and for international action at the moment, and I will finish with some thoughts on the role of China in this context. And please, as Brandon said, if you have questions at any point, just ask me. I'm happy to run it very informally. Can everyone hear me okay, by the way? Yes, fantastic. So I think all of us are quite familiar with the danger of climate change. Basically, it's not an environmental issue. Climate change will affect our societies in multiple ways. It will have implications for health. It will have implications because of the rising temperature, making worse pollution problems like you're experiencing, for example, in China with the rising temperature. This will get even more challenging. It will affect agriculture. It will affect infrastructure. So this graph here shows the dynamic of greenhouse gas emissions which are causing climate change from 1970s to 2010, where we are roughly. You can see quite a sharp increase in the global emissions of greenhouse gases. And what you can also see from this graph is that the share of emissions at in 1970s, the major share was coming from industrialized countries. But what is recently happening from around mid-90s, the share of developing countries has caught up, and now the emerging economies actually are responsible for the main growth in greenhouse gas emissions. So it's actually a very important issue for how can we address the rising greenhouse gas emissions in emerging economies while permitting economic growth and development. So here are some key data. To avoid dangerous climate change and keep it to the limit that will avoid drastic consequences, we need to stay below average temperature increase of 2 degrees. So that's what scientists are telling us, and actually 95% of scientists agree with this conclusion. In order to have at least 50% chance, I know that a lot of you come from financial community, so you would understand, at least 50% chance of reaching 2 degrees limit, we need to limit global emissions to 35 gigatons by the year 2030. And I'll come to this number because later I want to show you where we are heading and do we actually have a chance to reach this number. So how do we get there? We can do more, invest and reduce emissions now quicker, which will allow us to do less in the future, Or we can delay. We can wait, but then we will have to reduce emissions much quicker because we need to get to zero emissions by the end of the century to meet this goal. Again, many of you are economists and you will know that, you know, if we delay action and we have less time to act, and the cost of investment will be higher than to reduce emissions in the future. So what it means, there is a cost of delay. The longer we postpone aggressive international action, the more it will cost in the future. So here are some points in terms of what it means for the key sectors. Reaching the 2-degree goal and staying below, basically having zero net emissions. It means that by mid-century, in 2050, the emissions from electricity sector around the world should reach net zero. We also, if we assume that the world output, the global domestic product, will grow at roughly 3% on average, it means that we need to decrease the amount of emissions per unit of global output by 7-8-fold, which is drastic transformation, mainly in the energy sector, because the majority of emissions, they come from energy sector. Sure. Negative emission means that basically, for example, you also have sequestration technology, carbon capture and storage, for example. So for the coal industry, if you have carbon capture and storage, you can reach zero emission. But if you want to get to negative emissions, you need, for example, to do forest plantations in addition, which absorb carbon on top of what you're doing within the sector itself. So in this case, there would need to be some additional capture of greenhouse gases. What it also means is that, again, for those of you in finance community, it means that we're sitting on a huge carbon bubble of potentially unburnable resources, because what this graph shows is that fossil fuel reserves in some of the major countries. And so if we need to limit emissions of greenhouse gases to net zero by the end of the century, it means that a lot of this current carbon reserves, such as coal, oil, gas, they may not be consumed. And so a lot of countries or companies which are investing in these assets at the moment, they potentially having financial risk attached to their portfolio. Now, what's the positive side of the story? This is a very challenging task that we have ahead of us. Can actually this be achieved, and how much will it cost to put the world on the low carbon pathway? Here is some data from the recent analysis that came out last year, done by the New Climate Economy team. What they've looked at, the global investment needs, even if we don't think about climate change, we just think about population growth, energy demand that we expect internationally, the urban development that's happening. If we look at the investment needs, over the next 15 years, about $90 trillion needs to be invested in infrastructure globally. So what if we try to make this infrastructure low carbon? If we invest in energy efficient transport, if we put renewable energy instead of coal-based generation, if we go for sustainable cities, for efficient waste management, so that we can achieve the emission reduction that we are looking for, how much extra will it cost? And the estimate comes that it will cost just $4 trillion extra over the next 15 years, which is actually, if you think about it, it's quite a small additional investment, which puts us on a much more sustainable path. And that path doesn't only have climate benefits. In fact, it has other types of benefits. And I think you will probably... China is one country which has realized that one of the first, actually, I would say, for the health reasons. Because greenhouse gas emissions, which come from fossil fuel combustion, they also carry PM10, PM2.5 emissions. And so by reducing emissions of greenhouse gases from fossil fuel combustion, we are also increasing emissions of conventional pollutants. So what this graph shows are the avoided costs due to mortality from exposure to PM25. Attached to this scenario, if we actually reduce emissions to where we need to be for 2-degree pathway. And you can see that for China, the cost of this health cost attached to pollution just in 2.5, PM2.5, is close to 12% of the GDP. So reducing greenhouse gas emissions has massive local benefits such as health, such as efficient transport, and cleaner cities. So that's the context. Now, what's happening internationally? Because, as I said, this year is a critical one for international action. And you might be familiar, just to give you some context, the international framework at the moment, we have the Kyoto Protocol, which was agreed in 1997, and that was an international agreement which only required developed countries, industrialized countries, to limit greenhouse gas emissions. A few years ago, in 2009, for the first time, we had an initiative where developing countries came with voluntary pledges to reduce their emissions. And in Paris, what is expected in December this year is a comprehensive international framework which will apply to all of the countries around the world. So I'd like to give you some idea of what are the key issues in that agenda. So the key issues, roughly, I summarize here as this triangle. The first one is about ambition. How far do countries need to go, and how far can countries go with emission reduction actions that they will commit to in Paris and beyond? And that also carries equity issues, because one of the important questions for countries when they come up with how much they will do is, am I doing enough? Is my neighbor doing more than I'm doing, or am I doing more than others and I'm doing too much? And there are a lot of discussions about what the criteria for equity should be. Is it past emissions? Who is responsible for the history of the climate change issue? Is it capability, so to say, the income of the country, and so on? The second issue is feasibility. How much can we actually do given current status of technology? Is technology available to developing countries? And is there finance to support implementation? And the third issue is credibility, because you can make a pledge, promise as a country that you will do certain actions, but then you can decide not to do it. And we had that example with the United States, for example, committing to Kyoto Protocol and then withdrawing a few years later and not making its commitment. So all of these issues are at the center of negotiations in Paris. And I'll give you some insight on each of them. In terms of ambition, this map shows where we are today. You can see the slide of the country, the colors, so I'll walk you through it. So the dark countries are the ones that have commitments under the Kyoto Protocol, the 1997, the one I mentioned. So they already have binding emission reductions that they have committed to several years back. And those emission reductions, they are supposed to be achieved by 2012. Some countries have met the emission reductions, like European Union, for example. Other countries may face some issues. And Canada and United States have committed, but then walked away from the protocol. Then, the lighter blue, not the lightest blue, but the second shade, are developing countries which have made voluntary commitments in 2009 under the Copenhagen Accord. And at the moment, the process is going on of countries coming up and committing for what they will take on in Paris. So I'll show you here. These are, at the moment, 10 pledges have been made by various countries ahead of Paris negotiations. And you can see China at the bottom. China has not yet made its formal pledge for Paris, but it has communicated as part of the agreement with the United States on climate change action what potentially their pledge could be. So just going from top to down, so you have European Union and Switzerland taking absolute emission reduction targets. So they have already promised that they will reduce emissions by 40% to the level of 1990, the European Union. Then you have Mexico, the first developing country, which has made a commitment as well, which is quite ambitious for them. But they are linking their emission reduction to the growth of their economy. So they're not taking absolute emission reduction commitment, but they're saying, you know, this is what our emissions would be if we don't do any action. We will reduce our emissions below that baseline. So it's a kind of a dynamic emission reduction target. And then China, the preliminary announcement by China has been that it will peak its CO2 emissions by 2030, and it will increase the share of non-fossil fuel energy. So we are now eagerly waiting for the final communication from China, but this is what the government has said so far. A lot of this, as far as I understand, is related to the commitment or the policy of the government to peak its coal consumption. So basically there is an aspiration here domestically. And colleagues here, I know there are a few who work on energy issues in China, might want to comment later on this. So these are the pledges. We're still expecting these from about 100 more countries, which will be coming from now till October, November. So it will be interesting to see what happens. But we can say that we already have idea about the largest emitters, which are United States, China, and the European Union. And so what we have done here at the Institute, we have made an estimate what the total emissions from these three geographies would be, given their pledges for Paris, and what it would mean for the rest of the world, because there is some analysis of what the likely emissions for the rest of the world would be based on the current policies that are already adopted by government. And so when we sum it up, the total in 2030 comes to about 57 gigaton CO2 emissions. And if you recall my earlier slide where I showed you where we need to be below 2 degrees temperature increase, we need to be at 35. So we have about 20 to 25 gigaton CO2 overshoot from where we need to be to avoid dangerous climate change. So that message is actually quite alarming. So I posed in my talk the question, you know, battle lost, a case for optimism. So that's the first alarm here going on right now, that, you know, the pledges that are making, that countries are making at the moment, they don't put us on the most kind of cost-efficient pathway to reduce emissions. Now, is there a cause for optimism? So let me try and look into that. The cause for optimism, I think, comes from credibility story, and that's the second corner in the triangle that I mentioned. And the credibility is, it has to deal with two things for me. One is, do I mean what I say as a country? Am I going to meet my commitment? Am I going to actually go ahead with it? And secondly, am I going to be able to go ahead with it domestically, politically, technically? And so here we're looking at two aspects. Domestic development in the countries behind those promises that they make internationally. What are the legal structures? What are the institutional structures, policies that are being put in place? And secondly, at the international level, fine, in Paris in December, we know the pledges will probably not add up. What's next? Do we have a plan in the next 3-5 years to come together and again increase the level of ambition? So these are two issues for Paris. On the first one, there is, I think, a very positive story. This is a study that we have done at the Grantham Research Institute, looking at 66 countries around the world, covering actually the larger emitters. And what we've done, we have analyzed laws that have to do with climate and energy, and also policies. And you can see exponential growth almost in the number of climate policies and laws implemented in those countries. In particular, after, well, the growth started after 97, after the Kyoto Protocol was adopted, and then it's increasing ever since. And we'll be releasing new data for 99 countries next week, and the results are even more interesting there. So just to give you the geography, this is 97. The color shows the number of laws related to climate change and energy in various countries. So the darker the color, the more laws. This is 2013. So the picture is quite different. So countries are moving. There is a lot happening internationally. And that means that even though the pledges might not be as ambitious as they need to be, countries actually have built a good basis to implement what they're promising. This chart shows the key areas where climate legislation is happening. The leading one is energy supply, followed by energy demand. And then there is also quite a lot of legislation to set up ministries, agencies, and institutions dealing with climate change. Now, in terms of international aspects of how to make sure this credibility internationally continues beyond Paris and we have a way to increase climate ambition, what we need is a regular mechanism to review emission pledges. We also need some signal from Paris that will encourage countries to implement. Can you hear me like this? Or is that better?
Yeah,
because I think the microphone is... So basically what we need is some signal from Paris that will encourage countries to implement decarbonization policies nationally, and also mechanisms that will enable them to do that. So we need finance, we need de-risking mechanisms for low carbon investment. We also need capacity building for countries that have less experience, for example in Africa. Also in Asia, there are many countries that are still only starting on their climate and energy policy. And finally, we need to recognize that it's not only about countries, it's also about cities, companies taking action, and that action needs to be recognized and needs to be incentivized. So this is what's on the table for Paris in terms of credibility. Finally, I talked about feasibility. And effectively, to make low-carbon investment happening, investments such as renewable energy, energy efficiency, sustainable transport, we need for these three things to come together. We need to have technology that allows us to reduce emissions. We need to have finance that allows us to finance it. And sometimes they don't come together because technology might be too expensive or financing might be too risky. So we need policy, we need a policy framework that which will create conditions for that investment to happen. And so the feasibility aspect of it is about that. And that's another positive story I wanted to share. What this chart shows is the price of solar PV panels and how it has been changing since early 90s. Because a lot of time we hear that transition to low carbon is very expensive, it's not affordable. But look at this story. And a lot of this actually is China, thanks to China, because that's where the cost has been brought down and the market has completely changed. And so, in a sense, that tells us if we create the right policy conditions, it becomes actually quite affordable. However, it doesn't work for every low-carbon investment because, you know, I said there are local co-benefits like health, sustainable cities, and the question is, why is it not happening then if the prices are going down? It's not happening for the number of barriers which are specific to each country and to each technology. So you have financial barriers which the risk return profile of the investment may not be favorable for particular technology. For example, if a country, particular country, doesn't have experience with solar, banks will not lend to solar projects because they just don't know the technology and they don't want to take the risk. So we need an intervention, either some sort of de-risking mechanism, the government, public banks and so on, but also institutional, because setting up low-carbon policies takes time. It takes training for the government. It takes training also for private sector participants. And it costs money. There are also technical barriers. Information sometimes is not there. So even though the cost may not be so high, but we need to remove some of these barriers. So in terms of Paris agreements, there is a discussion, how can we help improve barriers through international initiatives? And one such way of doing it is international climate finance. So basically, developed country governments have committed several years ago in Copenhagen in 2009 that they will mobilize $100 billion annually from the year by 2020 to help developing countries transition to low carbon economy. And in Paris, the discussion will be, have we met this commitment? Has this money been mobilized? If not, how are we going to do this? And there is a big discussion how much of this is public money from the government and how much of this is private sector. So that's one question on the table for Paris negotiations. And then also what comes next and how to use this money. In this context, very important point and a role to play have development banks because they have the ability to, as I said, promote low carbon investment and remove some of the barriers. They can guarantee against default of risky projects. They can also give soft financing, so cheaper loans with low interest rate or sometimes even zero interest rate loans for programs which have high value kind of policy objectives. There is also this year, apart from the Paris negotiations, a very important process happening, which is called Financing for Sustainable Development. There will be a conference in Addis Ababa in July. And at that conference, there is a broader conversation on how do we finance transition to sustainable development actually beyond climate change. So that's another opportunity to raise finance for addressing climate change issues. And so that's something that we can expect for Paris. Now, what does it mean for business? I know a few of you are actually with business. Basically, what we have at the moment is... you have a question? What we have at the moment is... how the international framework post-Paris will look is still unknown. There is still some uncertainty. So private companies are kind of, private sector is taking their bets and kind of waiting a little bit on what's happening. But what is clear is that internationally countries are going towards low carbon future. Some countries are going faster, others are going slower. And private capital is expected to supply about 80% of that investment, of that $90 trillion over the next 15 years. 80% of that is expected to be private. There is a huge opportunity for investors, low carbon technology providers, to capture that market, because that market will be there. And basically... at the moment, that is also those companies who are engaging with governments, they have kind of early mover advantage to influence the direction in which the development of policy will go. Let's talk about China. I've already mentioned that China plays a huge role on this issue, firstly because of its size and the size of its emissions as well. The ability of us to address climate change internationally depends to a very large extent on how China will develop. But also, China has very important influence on other developing countries, because actually the conference I was attending here this week, it was exchange of experiences between China and other Asian countries who come here to learn about policy implementation that China is currently undertaking. And also innovation that happens in China plays a huge role in enabling low carbon transition. And the new development model that currently is being introduced here basically puts China in the leading position internationally as well. Because we have quite a change in the European dynamics at the moment. Europe has always been pushing for very strong climate policy internationally. But because of economic crisis, that stance has been weakening a little bit. They're still committing to quite ambitious goals, but they're not able to push as strongly as before. The U.S. situation, well, we know there is a strong opposition from Congress to climate change policy, although President Obama is going with climate change regulation through his executive power as much as he can do. But China actually has recognized that there are a lot of local benefits like energy security, health benefits, and that's why quite ambitious policy is being planned here. And there is also an aspect of outbound investment in China, in countries in Africa, for example. China, in many cases, becoming a major investor. And so the way in which those investments will go, do they go into low-carbon and high-carbon infrastructure, will determine the growth of emissions in those African countries over the next 20 and 30 years. So I think China is really becoming the most critical player on this issue internationally, and that's very promising. So to conclude, I think the situation is, the challenge is huge, and I think there is a case for being pessimistic in terms of us not taking as much as we should do globally in terms of reducing emissions. But I personally take an optimistic message, because I think looking at what's happening domestically around the world, this climate legislation story that I showed you, the recognition of local benefits in terms of air pollution reduction, sustainable cities, health, and being compatible with climate change goals, that really is a very positive story, and that gives me a lot of hope that we will succeed internationally in terms of going for more ambitious efforts in the future. But to be able to do that, I think what is critical is that Paris Agreement is not seen as the end of the journey. It's just something, you know, to start this new international framework where all countries are playing together. And I think that will have us, you know, going on the right path in the future. Thank you so much.